Now, this sculpture is the head of a bull or a minotaur with the body of a human, and the hands are palm up, reaching for the stars. And it said, Houston High School, through all conflicts and struggles, persisting to reach the stars. Now we'll go back.
Can you read that in the back? Very dramatic piece of sculpture. And he's captured that notion of persisting. But notice how students then can internalize these ideas, and they can begin using them and representing them as well. Another, managing impulsivity. Do you ever have students who blurt out an answer in class? Do you ever have this happen? You start to ask a question, and before you've even finished asking the question, the kids say, I know, call on me. That's impulsive. And I would use that term, by the way, with students, and they love the terminology, by the way. They can begin using this terminology at a very early life. And so we want to use the terminology and teach kids what it means to be impulsive and to know how to manage that. For example, here's an example. Now, notice, please, that management of impulsivity is as good for adults as it is for kids.
In this particular example, it's a man driving a cement truck on his way to work. He notices the picture of his wife on the dashboard, a beautiful woman. He drives back home. He wants to see her, and there's a blue convertible parked out front. He gets out and looks in the window, and there's a man giving his wife a bouquet of flowers and kisses her on the cheek. He goes back to his cement truck, backs the cement truck up, fills the blue convertible with the cement, gets back out of his cement truck, goes up to the window, and there he sees the production crew, his wife being handled a bouquet of flowers. She's won the car. And that's the story. We'll go back now.
You see? So we all need to know how to manage our impulsivity. Here's one student who has learned how to manage his impulsivity. This is Gage, is from British Columbia. So children can begin learning these at a very early age, and they love the terminology.
Now what Gage has done, there's a poster up, and it says, if your tooth falls out, don't yell out during study hall. Wait. Manage your impulsivity.
Terminology, and they take the terminology home to the parents, and the parents come and say, what is this thing called impulsivity, and do I do that, and how can I help my kid get better at it? So they get involved throughout the community as well. Just another example of how kids learn the terminology. I was in New Zealand recently, and in a kindergarten class, and this teacher had taught the kids that when she asked a complex question, that the kids need to stop and think and manage their impulsivity. And so the teacher asked a question, and in unison, all the kindergartners went like this, and they pointed to their head. And so I leaned over to one little girl, and I said, what are you doing? She said, I'm metacogitating. So they can start using the terminology very early, and we can begin listening, teaching them, and helping them to understand what is meant by impulsivity and how to control it. Another, taking responsible risks. You know, it's very interesting. I told you earlier about how these habits last kids throughout their lifetime. I just got a doctoral study over my desk, and this man has done a study of what are the characteristics of successful entrepreneurs. And he has identified 12 characteristics of successful entrepreneurs. This is a study in economics. And guess what they are? Persisting, taking responsible risks, such as this one. So we want kids to know how to venture forth. Do you ever have kids who are somewhat reluctant to offer an opinion? Well, we want kids to be able to offer it up, you know, to say, I may not be right, but I'm going to try. And that's the attitude that we want. That's going to last them throughout their lifetime. For example,
now, in this particular, this is a video, and it's Leonardo DiCaprio. It's a British film in a British study hall, and he's taken his test. There's a whole bunch of people. And then he gets involved reading something because he's finished and he's looked over his desk. And he doesn't notice that the person who's moderating it all has told them they can go and time's up. And so when he notices, then he gets up to turn in his paper and the man says, no, 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 you know, you're too late. And he says, do you know who I am? And he says, I haven't the faintest idea. And so he picks up at the shaft of papers and tests and shoves his right about into the center and lays it down, takes the apple off the desk, and away he goes, taking a risk.
Another, thinking flexibly. Have you ever known somebody that says, my mind is made up, don't confuse me with facts, that's it? That would not be considered a flexible thinker. A flexible thinker is one who says, well, you know, as a result of hearing everybody's idea, I think I'm coming to a different conclusion. As a result of gathering all this data, I think I'm coming to have a different opinion now. And so you hear that flexibility, that ability to change our minds, that ability to let go of some old ideas in order to accept some new ones. And so we want people to be flexible throughout their lifetime. Here's an example. I don't know if you can see this. Here's an example of a boss who may not be too flexible.
What we're seeing there is a suggestion box, and you put the suggestion in and it drops into a box that says resignations. Underneath it, there's a hole in the suggestion box.
Another, striving for accuracy. You know, our world depends on people who strive for accuracy. I'm going to get on the airplane in a little while, and I want the pilot and the ground crew to strive for accuracy. When my physician cuts into me, please strive for accuracy. See, we depend upon people to strive for accuracy in our lifetime. And yet, sometimes we have kids. You ever have kids who come in, they stick their homework assignment, their math paper under your nose, and they say, here, I'm done. And you say, have you checked this over to make sure you've got all the answers and you did the whole assignment? No, 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 I'm done. They're more anxious to get it out of their hair than they are to check for accuracy and precision. So one of the things that we want is for people to learn to this passion to monitor their own striving for accuracy, such as this. I don't know if you can read it. It says, would you please elaborate on, then something bad happened. You need to be a little bit more precise than just then something bad happened, you see. Do you ever listen to your children? Your kids ever talk like this? Well, you know, it's kind of like that weird stuff, you know? Now, if your kids talk like that, I want you to know that thinking and language are very closely entwined. And when you hear fuzzy, imprecise language, you're also hearing fuzzy, imprecise thinking. So we want kids to strive for accuracy, to have this passion for exactness and craftsmanship. Responding with wonderment and awe. You know, it's very interesting that people who are at the top of the heap, people who are really proficient, expert, maestros, find the world fascinating. The Einsteins of the world were entranced with mystery. They find the world intriguing. They find the world awesome. They have a high. In fact, let me ask you a question. Are there any joggers in here? Anybody jog? Yeah, some joggers. Have any of you, let me see the hands, have any of you ever had a jogger's high? That feeling of euphoria? Yeah? Now, it's kind of interesting to ask yourself about that because when you get that feeling, you know, feels, correct me if I'm wrong, feels like you could just go on and on and on. You lose track of distance, you lose track of time, you lose track of space. But why do you jog? My goodness, it takes a lot of time, a lot of energy, you get sweaty, you got to buy those expensive shoes, it's hard on the arches. What do you do that for, you see? And we find that what motivates people is that sense of euphoria, that those wonderful endorphins that are secreted. And would it be too bizarre, would it be too ridiculous to think about students having a learner's high, that they find that the act of learning in and of itself is so exhilarating that they want to do more of it. It's not the gold stars, it's not the feedback they get, but rather it's that excitement of the learning act themselves. That's what we want kids to do, is to learn how to respond, because Socrates said, all thinking begins with wondering. Well, there they are, content, important decision that you have to make, but there is no content without thinking skills. We design tasks to engage kids, and from that, over time, notice it's not just solving problems once, but it's becoming a good problem solver. Notice that it's not making one decision, but it's becoming a good decision maker. And so the habits of mind are those attributes, then, that we derive from the learnings over time. Well, the second one is thinking to learn. Martin Heidegger said, learning is an engagement of the mind that transforms the mind. So there can be no learning without some kind of thinking. Kids have to be engaged. Now, Maria Montessori was a champion of this, obviously. And so we know from brain research, and by the way, that's very interesting, that Montessori's teaching is being confirmed increasingly by research in the neurosciences now. And what she believed, but didn't have the scientific background for, although she had some, but is being increasingly confirmed that our brains function in that way. And so we know that each human being is unique, each child is different, and that we are a meaning-making organism. But meaning-making is not a spectator sport. It's not something that you do by passively watching, but rather it has to be engaging. Knowledge is a constructive process rather than a finding. In other words, it's not our transmission of content that's important, but rather it's how kids make meaning out of that content. Furthermore, it's not the content that gets stored in memory, but it's the activity of constructing it that gets stored. This is very interesting. You think kids memorize math facts, for example. Not true. They have to construct relationships. They have to see the patterns, and that's what gets stored in memory, is that process of constructing meaning. Furthermore, we know that humans don't get ideas, they make ideas. So it's not our transmission to them, but rather it's helping them construct meaning for themselves. And so, this is some research, very interesting, by Lauren Resnick from Pennsylvania. And she found that children who are held to low expectation and have not been taught how to think and problem solve accept the judgment that they have inborn aptitude, and that matters more than other people. For example, when she asked these kids, you know, why did you do well on your test? Why did Billy do well on his test? Well, he's smart. He's the brain in this classroom. And they attribute success to something that is innate, an innate IQ, and I am not creative. Mary's creative, but I'm not. Billy's smart, but I'm not. And so kids get this notion that their competence, you see, is built into genes and chromosomes. Now, Lauren Resnick found that students who are treated as if they are intelligent actually become so. If they are taught demanding content and are expected to explain and find connections, they learn more, and they learn more quickly, and they think of themselves as continual, powerful learners. This is why we give kids problems to solve. This is why we ask for them to form opinions. This is why we ask them to make meaning, is so that they see themselves as continual problem solvers, continual learners throughout a lifetime. Some of the instructional strategies that I'm sure you are using that have been found to help kids construct meaning are such as these: teaching for transfer, finding applications, asking kids when else might you use this, in what are the subjects, when in life, to bridge to other situations in life, to engage all the senses. Of course, this is what Maria Montessori taught us, is that we learn through our sensory channels, and the more channels that we can engage, the more powerful that learning will be. As you are forming your lessons, you might ask yourself, how many senses are going to be engaged in this lesson? Do kids have an opportunity to see, to touch, to smell, to move? And all of those senses, of course, is what enhances the learning. Scaffolding, making sure that kids have the previous knowledge to build upon as they learn something new, because we know that constructing meaning is taking old understandings, recombining them, finding patterns, finding continuity. And so we want to make sure that students have in their previous knowledge the scaffolds to support their new learning. Providing feedback for self-assessment. This is very interesting. We have found that kids who self-assess learn more than if the assessment comes from without. So engaging kids in developing their own self-assessment, their own rubrics, their own criteria, their own standards, and then to judge themselves against those standards provides better learning than if we give the standards and judge kids for them. Cooperative learning, one of the best ways to learn anything is to put kids into groups, to have them engage with others. And Vygotsky taught us a long time ago that our intelligence actually develops through the interaction with others, when we have to resolve differences, when we have to hear other people's opinions, when other people look at things differently and we have to accommodate that, we actually grow our intelligence. And of course, Socratic dialogue, having kids engaged in discussions and dialogues and listening to other kids, this is what enhances the strategies of learning. And finally, modeling, where we have to demonstrate and we have to display in our own behaviors. I'll tell you something very interesting. We have recently found something that are called mirror neurons. Let me explain to you mirror neurons. A group of monkeys were shown a film, and the film was of a person squeezing a tennis ball. This was done in Italy. And they put sensors on the monkey's arms, and they found that the same muscles and nerves were activated in the monkey's arm as they were watching the tennis ball being squeezed. Very interesting. And so they came up with this idea, this is a fellow named Guzzetta, and came up with this idea that there are certain neurons within us that mirror the behaviors of other people. Now, this helps to explain why in a chimpanzee, for example, and Jane Goodall found this, that a baby chimpanzee watches mama. Mama sticks a twig into an anthill, pulls it out, and licks off the ants. Pretty soon, baby starts doing the same thing. The most powerful way of learning is modeling, because we are built to imitate the behaviors of the significant others around us.
We're going to break right there. This is KZYX and Z FM, 90.7 FM Philo, 91.5 FM Willits in Ukiah, and 88.1 FM Fort Bragg. You're listening to Education Now. This is an address by Art Costa, 5 Thoughts for a More Thoughtful Curriculum, and we'll get back now.
Well, in what ways do you show that you value kids' point of view, that you cause students to question their own and others' assumptions, that you challenge kids with relevant problems, and that you structure your standards and units around long-range, big ideas and enduring concepts? You see, this is what Montessori, I think, really taught us, is that we want to honor the student's thinking. We want to engage them, listen to, and have each other listen to their thinking as well. So that we want kids then to start behaving intelligently, and therefore kids then develop their intelligence. Well, we talked about that. The third one, thinking about our own thinking. You know, it's very interesting that we as humans are the only form of life that can stand off and look down upon our own thinking while we are thinking. It's like standing on a balcony and looking down upon ourselves on a stage. And the reason why this is unique is because it takes place in the neocortex of the brain, and we are the only form of life that have a well-developed neocortex. And so we have this ability to monitor our own thinking. For example, while you are teaching, do you ever hear yourself talk to yourself? Do you? Do you ever hear yourself saying, I think I better slow down? I think I better speed up. I got to remember to review this tomorrow. Do any of you hear yourself saying, this isn't working? Yeah? You see, you are monitoring your own thought processes. Now, this is a unique human capability. Now, what's very interesting is the research shows, and the research by Flavel from Harvard, Jean Piaget when he was alive, Ruben Feuerstein and others found that not everybody has that capacity. As a matter of fact, only about 2/3 of the adult population has this ability to think about their own thinking. For example, have you ever asked a kid, how'd you solve that problem? What were the steps that you went through in order to come up with that conclusion? Tell us what was going on inside your head. And the kid says, I don't know, I just did it. There's a lack of metacognitive awareness, and yet Alan Schoenfield at Berkeley finds that what distinguishes expertise in problem solving is this ability to think and then to think about our thinking. And so we want to engage students in dialogue about our own thinking processes. talking aloud about our thought processes. For example, I'm going to give you a little problem, and what I'd like you to do is to turn to your neighbor and talk out loud about how you're solving this problem. And see if there are any discrepancies for you. See if you agree with your partner. See if you solved it in the same way. Okay, are you ready? Let me give you this little problem. You ready? Here's your problem. How much is 1/2 of 2 + 2? Turn to your partner, talk out loud about what you're doing inside your head. All right, let's give your attention back up here. How many of you found that you solved, that each of you solved the problem in a different way? Now, that's what's exciting, you see, is that when we get kids to talk aloud about their problem solving, that it actually expands their repertoire of problem solving, because we have to listen to other people. We have to consider their point of view. We have to say, oh, there is more than one way to solve this problem. Some of you may have come up with a different answer. I mean, how many of you said 2 is the right answer? How many of you said 3 is the right answer? Isn't that wonderful? We had more than one answer to that problem. Now, how you resolve those differences, see, is actually an intelligence-building process. And so we want kids then, we want to pose challenging problems and then invite them to describe what's going on inside their head, just as you did, to share their thinking as they are implementing a plan of problem solving, and to reflect on that and say, well, which worked or what didn't work, or when I might use that again, or I've got to listen to other people in future situations. So we want then in the classroom for kids to begin talking aloud about their problem solving. This is something we call TAPS, T-A-P-S, and that stands for Think Aloud Problem Solving. You want to try another one? Okay, here we go. You still got that intelligent looking partner that you're next to? Try this one. Now, what I want you to do is to share your thinking, talk aloud about how you're approaching and how you're solving this problem. Here we go. You ready? If day before yesterday were Sunday, then what would day after tomorrow be? I'll repeat it. If day before yesterday were Sunday, then what would day after tomorrow be? Please turn to your partner, talk out loud about how you're solving that problem. All right. Let us come back together. How many of you found that your partner used a very different approach, very different strategy to solving this problem than you did? And that's wonderful. Sometimes we purposely put kids together because they have different learning styles, different problem-solving styles, and so that they can expand their repertoire. The whole purpose of metacognition is to become more conscious of our own thinking, strategies, and behaviors, and of their effects on others and on the environment. I think you can see from this picture that these workers are not particularly aware of their own thought processes.
What he's talking about there is that they've misspelled the word school in a school crossing.
So what we do then, as I said, is to give kids problems to solve and invite them to think about their thinking, thinking aloud about their thinking. In your classrooms, I want to suggest to you that you have discussions about the thinking process. That taking time to talk about how you're solving problems, what approaches that you use, when else might you use that approach, this is time well spent. The other reason is because we need to build flexibility. We need to become aware of our own thinking and examine it and see if that's the kind of thinking that we do. As John Kenneth Galbraith said, faced with the choice between changing one mind and proving that there is no need to do so, almost everybody gets busy on the proof. We tend to defend our own biases and perceptions. We tend to justify our way of thinking rather than standing off and examining them and seeing if this is really serving me. For example, Eric Ellenberg said, continuing to cling to the patterns you know inhibits your ability to discover what you don't know. And so sometimes it behooves us to give up some of our old perceptions, to let go of them, because this opens the door to some new ways of thinking. This is one of the most difficult things for adults to do, is to admit that some of our old perceptions, our old mental models do not serve us anymore, and to begin changing them. And, of course, as Shakespeare said in King Lear, there's nothing so confining as the prisons of our own perceptions. And so the purpose of metacognition is to cause students then to stand off, look down upon their thinking and saying, is this the best thinking that I can do at this time? What other ways might I be thinking? What do I need to change in my thinking to make it even better? The fourth is thinking together. Our ability to think interdependently seems to be very important. Do you know, anybody care to make a guess, what is the main reason why people lose their jobs? Can't get along. Very interesting. And yet, the problems that are facing our world cannot be solved alone. They're too big for any one person. Teams of people need to learn how to work together to solve the multitude of problems that are facing our environment. And this is happening repeatedly as we see a globalization in which people in India, for example, are helping us solve our problems by thinking interdependent with us here, where it's becoming worldwide problem solving. So we need then to learn how to think together. Now, what's very interesting is that in our schools, and by the way, this is some research done in Chicago, we have found, or it has been found, I didn't find it, but these researchers found that achievement is higher in those schools where there is high degree of trust. Very interesting. And that trust exists between the professional, the teachers, and the parents, between the principal and the teachers, between the teacher and the teacher, and between the teacher and the student. Achievement is higher in those schools where trust is higher. Now, we probably knew that before, intuitively, but now we've got some research to back it up. And I believe, Bill Summers, you're going to talk more about this in your workshop, aren't you? All right. So that we're finding that. Now, what is it that we do to create trust? Well, the main skill in trust building is to know how to communicate, to know how to engage in dialogue. And that's what this research found, that it was the quality of the conversations that take place in the school. David Perkins says that your organization functions and grows through conversations. And the quality of those conversations determines how smart your organization is. Now, what we're finding is that we need to teach children the skills of listening. We as adults need to become better listeners. Did you know that we spend 55% of our lives listening, and yet it is one of the least taught skills in school? Oh yeah, we say, listen up, pay attention, but that's not the kind of listening I'm talking about. I'm talking about devoting your mind to another person for a given period of time, setting aside some of your own thoughts, some of your own experiences, your own solutions, your own value judgments, and instead listening to that other person. You know, very often we as adults say that we're listening, when actually what we're doing is rehearsing in our heads what we're going to say next when our partner is finished. It's kind of like this cartoon, Calvin and Hobbes. Can you read that in the back? Now, that's kind of how we approach contests. You know, it's like a ping pong match. You say something, I say something, you say something, I say something. But we never really listen to each other. And so one of the great skills, then, that we want to teach kids is to how to empathize, how to listen with understanding and empathy to another person, how to pause your brain, how to pause your lips and not overtalk another person or interrupt, how to pause your brain in such a way that you are really devoting your mental energies to another person, how to paraphrase to make sure that other people that you understand what the other person is saying, how to clarify when you don't understand. In other words, it's learning those skills of dialogue that is so important in thinking interdependently, to be able to listen to another person. So I would ask you, in your staff, how well do you listen to one another? Can you disagree gracefully? Do you know how to disagree with another person? There are certain ways of doing it. Let me tell you what a couple of ways are. One, you listen to the other person's point of view. You paraphrase what they say. And then you say, I think I'm seeing it differently. That gives you permission when you paraphrase. Because as Covey said, you know, seek to understand before being understood. So make sure that you understand the other person, and then you can disagree with them. So that's the graceful way of doing it. Can you take another person's point of view? Can you say, if I were Marianne, here's how I look at this, because this is the way she's viewing the world? And how well do you value each other's style differences? You might ask yourself these questions as a staff, as well as a classroom, so that we learn how to listen to one another and begin thinking together as an interdependent group. The fifth big idea is to begin thinking big. Thinking big and long range. Let me explain to you what I mean by this. One is to remain open to continuous learning. It's very interesting, in our studies, we have found that people who are at the top of their profession, I'm talking about the Tiger Woods of the world, you know, and he's well up there, wouldn't you say? I'm talking about the Mikhail Baryshnikov of the world. And we find that to a person, each one of them said, but I've got so much more to learn. Now, isn't that interesting that here is a person who are already near perfection? Here are people who are noteworthy because of their accomplishments, and they all have a common attribute. They say, but I've got so much more to learn. It was very interesting. Tiger Woods was in the PGA Open in Hawaii, and he was interviewed with a local television network right after, and they showed video clips of himself. And he saw himself on this video, and his comments were, oh, did you see that putt? It was awful. I've really got to work on that putt. Now, here's Tiger Woods, you see, who is well up there, and he's saying, I've got so much more to learn. Think about the Olympics. What do they do with the bar when the pole vaulter has cleared it, or when the high jumper has cleared it? Always raise it. It's that whole notion. I've got so much more. I want to break my record. I want to continue to learn. And that's the attitude that we want with students, and that's going to carry them throughout the rest of their life. And so when we think big, we're thinking about how is this going to contribute then to the students' continual learning? Will they love learning even more as a result of experiencing this? So we want to start asking ourselves, how do these learnings help students become the kind of people we want them to be? Why are these considered essential? Why do kids need to know this? Is this something that they're going to use for the rest of their life? How many of you remember from your high school calculus class the use of binomials? Yeah? How many of you used them recently? A few of you have, yeah. But for the majority, notice that in your high school algebra class or high school geometry class, it's the learnings that are left over after you've forgotten everything. That's the essential kind of learning. It's the essence that you carry forward. And what we're carrying forward are the thinking skills, the problem-solving skills, the dispositions, the joy of learning. That's what gets carried forward with it. Now, we have to remember that, of course, we're going to use some of that content in later life, but for the great majority, it's the attitude towards learning that content that is more important. And how do they enhance our vision of classrooms and schools and communities in a world that are more thoughtful places? Let me share with you a quote that I love from Alan Kay. Alan Kay is the one who designed the computer, the filing system for the Apple computer. And Alan Kay said, the best way to predict the future is to invent it. Now that's kind of interesting for us. If we want a world that is much more thoughtful, if we want a world that is much more compassionate, if we want a world that is much more peaceful, then we have to invent it. And the reason why, you see, is because the future is in your classroom today. Thank you very much for letting me be with you.
Well, there we have it. That was Art Costa, 5 Thoughts for a More Thoughtful Curriculum. If you want to contact Art about this address, his email is artcosta, that's artcosta, at aol.com. I really hoped you enjoyed that. I wanted to talk to you tonight about the senses and Carl Jung and movement and all the things that Art brought up, but we're really running out of time. One of the things that I have is our senses more than windows to the world, which is an article by Joy Turner. If any of you are interested in this article, I would be more than happy to send it to you if you would write to me at P.O. Box 1, Philo, California. And just address that to Athena. Or you can send me an email at Hermes, that's H-E-R-M-E-S, at pacific.net. You can also reach me and find out more about me on my website, which is, let me give it to you just exactly, www.pacificsites.com/TildaHermes, H-E-R-M-E-S. And there you can find out more about me and about our show. And you can find, this show will be up. You can download it. You can hear it. The show I did with Alfie Cohen last month and the show that I did with William Crane are also on that website. let's go to some music now and we'll do some more talking.